This is Gemma Redgrave, and you're listening to Gallifrey Public Radio.
I'm Joe from PopX Cast, where science fiction meets pop culture. Part of the Gonna Geek Network, just like the show you're checking out now. Shows on the network are individually owned, and the opinions expressed may not reflect others. Find more stunningly awesome geeky shows at GonnaGeekNetwork.com.
You've dialed into Gallifrey Public Radio. We're a podcast dedicated to positive enjoyment of everything in the Doctor Who spectrum. Join us for weekly discussions ranging from Hartnell to Whittaker and well beyond. Your hosts are Jay Witten.
I choose Death by Scotland.
Keir Hansen.
Arun, Arun, Arun.
And Haley Malley.
Darth Vader, he's a villain, right?
We travel through classic and new Who, explore the extended Whovian universe, and play a few games from time to time if we're left unsupervised. Oh, and a word on spoilers. We do discuss recent news, content that has been officially released, and the occasional interesting rumor. But don't worry. If we look too far into the future, we'll give you fair warning.
Welcome to episode 324 of Gallifrey Public Radio, where we're preparing for battle with the Evil One. You shall not intimidate us, Skype, for we are armed with the holy backup hard drives of the Seagate. I'm Jay.
I'm Keir.
And I'm Haley. And this week, we meet Leela of the Seven Team and get a glimpse of the Fourth Doctor completely at a loss in the face of evil. More giant Baker heads than you can wave a scuttled piece of starship debris at.
They're just floating everywhere.
Right?
Each one just looks cooler than the last, you know?
Yeah. Why pay a new actor when you can use the one you already have to pay anyways?
Especially when you got one that could just, you know, emote like that. All right, so, all right, let's put him in plaster, up on this model. Let's get big projections of him up in the sky. Let's put him up on this wall. Let's put him up on these giant jumbotrons. Just bigger, 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 bigger. All right.
I heard you like bigger, so we put bigger in your bigger.
Yo, dog. All right, well, we always got to begin these things with getting familiarity and sort of the hot takes. So, Haley, we'll turn to you first on this, being your first spin through this particular story. What did you think of The Face of Evil?
For the most part, I liked it. It has the same problem that the last few stories have had, though, which is, what happened to all the women?
Yeah, yeah, which really, in this one, just defies a lot of logic in the survival.
Yeah, I've got a lot of points to make off of that, but I'll let everybody get their hot takes out first.
All right. But in general, the story was pretty engaging and entertaining.
Yeah, I think it was really well paced. It was a good introduction of a new character, a different kind of companion than we've had up to this point. So I'm looking forward to seeing where they go with that.
Okay, got it. All right. Now, Jay, how familiar were you with this particular story?
High points only. I don't think I've ever actually seen it.
Oh, okay.
I knew the general gist of it, but that's about it. Like, I knew it was Leela's first appearance. I knew this is where we got the Seva team, but that was about it.
Okay.
So this was all relatively new for me.
Cool. All right. And what was your general take from it?
I liked it. I thought it was fun. And like Haley said, it was paced really well, but there were a lot of times where I'm like, wow, we're already resolving this, but what's the rest of the story going to be about? Like, it seemed to move a lot quicker than I expected it to.
True. Yeah. Okay. And I want to unpack, each of those aspects along with a couple of other things that I know that we all kind of, realized throughout. But let's take this apart. Haley, this was predominant in my mind, and it seems to be even more so every time I go back and revisit the story. The fact that Leela being as capable and as and eventually by story's close as respected as she is by her tribe, where are all the rest of the warrior women?
Right. It doesn't seem like it's a patriarchal society. She seems to be an equal with the men in the tribe. Mm-hmm. Where are the women? Also, it seems like Zoannan, is that the name of the computer thing?
Yep. Zoannan, yep.
Yep. Zoannan. It seems like the plan at the end was to breed the best members of both of these tribes it had created together to create a super tribe, and neither tribe had any women except for Leela. So
it was already determined.
I don't know how that breeding program is going to work.
Well, she was the top. She was absolute top. Zoannan already knew You know, she was a top echelon.
But what if she had gotten, I don't know, measles as a 7-year-old and died? Then there would be no women.
It's a flawed eugenics plan.
She tripped and fell on a Janus thorn, and now you don't have any women to breed.
Those Janus thorns, yeah. okay. Well, yeah, not to mention the fact that over on the Tesh side of things, we don't really know exactly how many generations have passed, because I thought that was always a fascinating, you know, and watching the Seva team actually come to that conclusion about the, wait a second, where are we in this? Are we, did we just lose memory and we were the actual, you know, we were the indigenous peoples and we captured this, these spacemen of which you speak of, Doctor, or are we the offspring? And if that's the case, how many generations down the line are we? And if that's the case, where are the women at?
Right? Yeah. So, but I did love the fact that that was like, it was a question that they posed, but they didn't ever answer it. Mm. And I feel like that's all too often. That's the, they're like, oh, well, we brought up this topic, so let's go and, you know, we have to describe every single thing.
Spend an episode and a half getting into that.
Yeah.
I mean, so it's, I like the fact that it was left there like, wow, that's an interesting thought problem. Moving on.
Well, we addressed it. We name checked it. So let's just go on to the good stuff.
It's an interesting question. The answer is not as interesting. So
exactly,
move on.
Mm-hmm. Exactly. I think this, I'm sure that better continuity experts than we have taken this apart and figured out some ways to be able to sort of work it into canon and have everything sort of resolve itself to us to a whatever an acceptable degree by their estimation. But in just at surface level, you can look at this and say, yeah, the plot holes. And just referencing them very quickly or sort of dancing past them and saying, oh, look over there, lack of female characters, and then moving on past it doesn't put it to rest. I got to agree with you, Haley. There's enough going on in the story to keep it engaging and entertaining in that respect, but it never completely leaves your mind because you're constantly through the story, in fact, pretty consistently on a rising level through every episode, you're getting more and more gains to Leela's character. You know, she's proving herself to be more and more capable, or more intelligent than, and this is one of the points that I wanted to discuss with you, even more intelligent and perceptive and adaptive than even she realizes. Like, she demonstrates things the Doctor starts crediting her for, you know, calling her genius for making all these realizations and coming to these conclusions.
Well, and he makes a point at the beginning, you know, answers are easy. It's figuring out the right question that's hard. And she asks the right question several times.
Repeatedly, yeah. So that's something, I mean, if that's the case, then that itself becomes a reminder. You're like, how did all these other boobs running around, whether they be the knife-wielding boobs or the bowing and genuflecting boobs over the other side of the barrier.
Oh, the bowing was so obnoxious.
I wouldn't mind it so much if it were faster. It's such a slow
except for Caleb, who was kind of delightfully devious.
Yeah, that's true. All right. Well, let's take a second. Let's look at the Seva team themselves. All right. You know, obviously, you know, hate using the term savage, but this sort of this tribal, very earth-connected society. They seem to have a sort of an order, but they are sort of relying a bit on their shamanism and things like that to be their guidance and all. But there's this, you know, there's a pass down of power, recognition of authority, rule of law. They're not complete. It's not anarchy. It's not cavemen. I do really love the little subtle things that Phil Hinchcliffe and the director Pennant Roberts and the crew decided to work all of the discarded technology into their society, all the different ways that they incorporated the detritus that they found from the Starfall 7 ships, even just down to costume designs. Jay, you would pick up on this. I mean, because we've all seen a number of sci-fi stories where it's a matter of somewhere in the distant future where, society has completely rolled itself back or civilization has rolled itself back and the technology of today are the archaic relics of the past. Jay, did you ever play, Event Horizon Zero Dawn?
Yes.
Okay. Tell me this doesn't scream of that being just a beautiful nod to this sort of a genre, you know,
Oh yeah.
Okay.
Absolutely.
Now, So here, I'm going to ask you both. When it comes to things like the, especially because both of you said that this is a relatively new story to both of you. Jay, you had it in pieces, mm-hmm. but getting it as a complete through line, the moment the penny drops and you realize that not only are you dealing with the team that becomes the Seva team, right?
But now the survey team, yeah.
Right. Realizing that now on the flip side of the survey team, the Tesh are the technicians. How did that, when you get that nice little gift from the writer, how did that resolve with you both?
You know, it made a lot of sense. The minute that they revealed the Seva team was the survey team, mm-hmm. my brain automatically started going to it. I'm like, all right, what's Tesh? What could Tesh be? And I was like trying to figure it out the whole time. And I was too. Yeah. I never went to tech, you know, and I was like, oh, okay. Well, that makes sense. I guess I get that. And it's, so it wasn't this like, oh my God, kind of revelation, but it was, it was a nice little resolve to it. It's like, okay, yep. Perfect sense. Yeah.
Cool. All right.
Also, have either of you ever read The Time Machine by H.G. Wells?
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
Yeah. Very much like this. You've got, you know, the two societies that humanity evolved into with, you know, the brawn and the brain being very different and separate for some reason. And this one, it kind of explained why, because they were teams selected for specific traits.
Right.
Yeah.
And then cultivated over time by Zoanne and manipulated them.
Right. By a manipulative hand.
When we were talking about how far, you know, how long this experiment had been going on necessarily, regardless of, you know, putting aside the fact that we don't know exactly how they propagated. But the fact that the Tesh had that pallor, that almost data-like android looking pallor to their skin, the greenish yellow glow from being within the confines of their location under whatever, maybe the artificial lights or something. That's the only way that I sort of in my head put it together. Was it a matter of they've been in there long enough that their skin has become pallid and bizarre while the Seva team are these bronze gods and goddesses. Well,
they've got fluorescent tans.
Well, spray tans. But okay. So now we've got things like, well, within the Tesh, you've got their particular established order that seems, you know, their titles like acolytes and whatnot, but they're still bearing names like Gentech, which says to me, oh, general technician. Okay. So they haven't strayed too far from their point of origin, whether or not they're completely cognizant of it. Much more aware of the technology that they're using, but are still under, you know, mind control and guidance.
Well, and that makes a lot of sense too, because like the technicians would be in working with that equipment, stuff like that. Whereas the, you know, the survey team, they would need to be able to make do with what they find on, you know, it's like their whole job is like, you're going to be out in the wilderness. You have to know how to survive in case, you know, your battery runs out or something like that.
Sure.
Yeah.
So it makes sense that they would just be like, oh, well, you know, we have these random bits that we haven't used in forever. I don't know what to do with it. Whereas the technicians are constantly in there. So it's, yeah.
Mm. Well, and also they probably have some sort of written record within the ship itself to kind of maintain knowledge, whereas they might not have that out with the Seva team.
Mm. Mm-hmm. Well, also the conscious decision, play on words, conscious decision by the AI to use them as the cultivation of superior intellect. So it's feeding them with more information on that regard than it would be passing along to the Seva team on the flip side of things. I'm curious to get your opinions on, as far as the use of things like the time barrier, you know, that slight manipulation, I keep coming across that as the separation wall that the Doctor takes apart. It always struck me as like this aspect to the story that could have been something that could have taken it entirely in a different direction. You know, you've protected this one region by setting it a few seconds out of sync with time, which is something we've played with a few times since in Doctor Who, but it had the potential of being something so much more. You know, did it feel like a red herring to you after you get the resolution?
Yeah. So I thought, like, since the story is playing with, like, evolving two different societies, like, what if time was passing differently in one section than the other? To, you know, allow accelerated evolution of some trait.
Okay.
Like, I feel like there was more that could have been done with it than what was.
Hmm. All right.
To me, it kind of reminded me of, like, anyone that's ever played like tabletop RPGs and you have like, you can tell that the GM is guiding you to a place, but he doesn't want you to get there yet. Mm. And it's like, okay, well, you know, you're supposed to go fight this big bad guy, but I don't want you to run in there and get killed yet. So they're slightly out of sync in time.
Okay.
And it's just, you can tell it's just this, well, yeah, it's they came up with this weird thing that sounds kind of interesting, but really serves no purpose whatsoever other than to keep you away.
It's and the here be dragons part of the map.
Yeah.
Right. Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. And that's really what this felt like, was just a, well, we needed some reason for the doctor not to just head straight there.
Okay. All right. Well, that actually, that pokes me in the brain for something entirely different now. So since I want first impression reactions to when you had heard the voice of the god Zoannan, you know, speaking to the 17 in clearly Baker's voice, and all of the references to the doctor not recalling whether or not he had been here before. I love when the doctor's memory fails. Mm-hmm. I mean, we love the doctor being this brilliant, the collected knowledge of centuries of existence and experiences and adventures. But those moments when
too much stuff in his head, he needs a bigger head.
Exactly. You know, it's because I watched too many cartoons.
Well, they gave him one.
I watched too many cartoons when I was a kid, which is why I can't remember phone numbers today. My brain is full and other things have to make room for other things. Yeah. So, mm-hmm. But how did your processing try to resolve that as you were going through the story?
I thought we were going to get a fun, like, playing with time thing, which we don't get very often in Doctor mm-hmm. Who, mm-hmm. you know, a show ostensibly about time travel. We don't get them playing with the idea of time travel very often.
Okay.
I thought we might be going that way with the time wall and the Doctor clearly being the voice on the other side. Yeah. Like, maybe that is him. Maybe it's later. And he just hasn't gotten there yet.
Yeah, that's kind of what I was hoping for, too, was like the Doctor does something in his future, which is in their past kind of thing. And like,
right.
I was really hoping that that's how that was going to play out. But yeah, as soon as I heard I was like, is that Baker's voice? Are they really like reusing his voice for this? What the heck? Like,
right. Well, and then for a while I was like, oh, they just didn't want to pay somebody else to do it. So they were like, yeah, you've like, got a good voice.
It wasn't even trying to disguise the fact that it was him. Like, it was just,
right.
It was bothering me.
But then there's the kicker. So you can go ahead and I can see where your processing might say, all right, well, maybe this is, since they've already really well established at this point, the idea of regenerations past, and potential regenerations future. Maybe this is something where the doctor does something in his or her future that has yet to be processed. But then at the close of the first episode, you're clearly looking at Baker's mug up on the mountaintop.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's just, I can't remember the first time I saw the story, and I honestly can't remember whether or not I saw it sequentially or whether it was all broken up by PBS because whatever PBS. But I can't imagine what it's like trying to say, like, wait a second, he doesn't know what's going on. There's no way they got the voice and the face right just on a whim. So yeah, it has to lead you to, okay, something's going to happen towards the tail end of the story that is a, hey, Ted, don't forget to wind your watch, turn back.
Yeah.
That never happens, you know? I love so much about this story. I really do.
The minute that you see the face carved on the rock, like, I remember when the whole Pandorica thing, the story happened. I can't remember who it was I was talking to, but it was somebody I was guiding through the new series, and they got there, and I was like, oh god, I can't wait to find out what they thought. And they were like, oh no, I knew it was going to be the Doctor because, well, it's always the Doctor.
Right, right.
And that was my reaction when I was like, you know, I was trying to figure it out through the whole first episode, and then as soon as I saw his face, I was like, oh well, of course, it's always the Doctor. So at that point, I was like, all right, now I'm just going to sit here and watch it unwind and see how he did this thing.
Yeah. And the amazing thing that at the end is you can just chalk it up to the fact that he honestly forgot that he did this. I mean, just, I've done so much in such a short amount of time that you, the audience, have seen that I simply forgot that I went and tried to help this away team with this thing and clearly botched it up. I do also really love the fallibility of the Doctor in this.
Yeah. Well, because the Doctor never deals with the consequences of his actions. Yeah. Like, he finishes his thing and leaves and doesn't care what happens after for the most part. And this is one of the few times we see what happens after.
And isn't it great? It's just mm-hmm. delicious, you know, because then it's either you have to go to great lengths to try to correct it or resolve it. Or in the case of a more modern Doctor, you wear it as baggage like a albatross around your neck for decades and it ends up torturing you, which makes you a more interesting character. So, hey. Yeah. Well, all right. So then we get the way that Zoanin is actually portrayed when we start finding more and more about how it functions and what it has become and the Doctor's exposition as his memory starts to come to him and say, oh, well, you know, I did this. Clearly it has become, you know, I'm trying to remember whether or not this is actually the first time the Doctor can say it's the first of its kind talking about a sentient AI that has now become living, because we've now worked that a few times. But I don't know if this chronologically was the first or not. Wibbly wobbly.
It's the hybrid.
It is the hybrid. but I just remembered thinking to myself, well, at least it's not Wotan.
Oh, God.
Right? But yeah, I mean, as far as the way that it was presented to the viewer, you know, the concurrent voices, the imagery, the, you know, the echoing within the Doctor's mind and everything. I don't know. I'd like to get your reaction. I felt it was personally really, really effective in just showing the idea of this mind, this malformed, but still young mind. Mm-hmm. Just trying to grapple with its identity and lashing out at the only person that it genuinely knows, inherently knows, because it's built on that person. How did that feel to you?
I really did enjoy that part. Although I will say it's like horribly unsettling to see or to hear a child screaming like, who or what am I or whatever, and seeing Baker's mouth forming the words. That was creepy on a whole new level. But aside from that, like it made a lot of sense to have, you know, this being just kind of like, no, I recognize you, you know, you're us within us or whatever. And it worked so well. And then when the more you learn about it, the more you're like, okay, well, yeah, it would like latch on to basically its dad, you know, or mom, depending on how you, I don't know, whatever.
Dad, mom, self. I mean, it was such a folded identity. And I got to give Chris Boucher a lot of credit as far as sort of putting it together. If you look at the dialogue that's broken up across all of the voices in that particular sequence, I mean, it's really some sort of a crazy therapy session, you know, of it trying to work this through and lashing out at the one person who is both going to be their savior, but is also the one to blame. So it's just this really interesting dynamic. I just found that really compelling. Every time I see it, I just keep thinking, I'm like, damn, that's a really solid scene. And it's just him talking to effectively himself. So, Haley, how did you feel about the idea of, well, specifically, you've got, I'm kind of curious about I always like the Neva character. I like the one who you hate at the beginning, but then you realize that they have maybe not always merit, but at least significance to the greater story.
I thought he was like the second least interesting character in the story after the Puts of a King.
Second least interesting. Okay.
Oh. Huh. I don't know. Because he's the guy who's listening to the voice in the box and following it blindly. And I wasn't crazy about him.
Interesting.
He seemed like the most generic character. Like, you know, he was the peg that fit in the hole of the Doctor Who story.
Okay. All right. So when he comes to the realization or has to have this great epiphany that it's time to kill his own god and that sort of thing, and that he feels that his existence has been wasted because he's been manipulated, that didn't kind of register with you?
I think I was over him by that point.
Yeah. Could have spoiled it. If that had come around a little earlier in the storyline, it might have saved him.
Maybe if he hadn't spent so much of the story, like, as the mind-controlled zombie.
Okay. All right. Well, this is something that I wanted to actually check with both of you, because this sort of pulls back from the story itself and into the actual construct of the plot line. Did either of you feel at a certain point that mind manipulation was being a little overused in the story?
Yes.
Oh, absolutely.
Okay. Would there have been ways that you could see that would have allowed us to be able to come to the same path other than just, you know, getting you out of a scrape where everybody's pointing guns at each other? That's one thing. Mind manipulation is your, is your quick little, your saving throw on that one. But just, I think if you had just toned it back a bit, because it got pretty commonplace by about the close of the third episode where every other scene was either getting kicked off or resolved by somebody touching their forehead and getting Zoannized. Zoannized.
It was used too many times, clearly.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right.
Yeah. Because, I mean, it was, there were plenty of times where it's like, you know, give the character some kind of motivation to do this. Or it would have been easy as hell to be like, well, you know, I just gut instinct. I kind of went with it. And that's why I attacked you. Kind of like, instead, you've got to go through this whole like mind control thing for the 15th time in 3 minutes.
Right.
It just, it was absolutely too much. And it just, it made when it did happen that much, or when it would have fit, it made it that much less impactful because like, you're like, okay, again.
Yeah.
But it's like, that would have been the perfect time to use it, but I've already seen it 8 times this episode.
Cheapened through reuse. Yeah. Okay. Yeah. And especially when it gets to the point where everybody but the doctor is now being manipulated and the whole gang's jumping in on him. Okay. All right. Well then let's button this up by just talking about the idea of Leela as a new potential companion, or the sort of the backhanded way in which she becomes. Okay, don't touch that.
You don't tell me I'm not the companion. I tell you if I'm not the companion.
All right. So here's the question for you. Do you think the doctor was playing her and was absolutely willing to take her on as a companion, or did it actually play out as written or screen?
I think he intended to leave her behind to lead these people.
Okay.
Yeah. I don't know if he left her behind to lead them, but he definitely was like, all right, my part's done. I'm out. And he just, I mean, that was it. He was getting in the TARDIS and heading out. He was leaving her to, you know, to be part of whatever solution this resolved with. But this was very much, you know, the moon is an egg kind of thing where he's like, all right, my part in this is done. This is on the rest of you.
Mm. Okay.
How dare you bring that up?
Well,
too soon.
Thankfully, if you do want to, you've got plenty of other stories that can allow you to continue to delve into the goings-on with the Seva team after Leela's exit. Thanks, Big Finish. And even if you want to find out what happens with Leela after she's no longer with Doctor Who, hey, thanks, Big Finish. Hey! They love Louise Jameson.
Oh, yes.
Okay. But, so there you have it. So now we can sort of just go around real quick and just talk about rewatchability and recommendability. Now, I'm going to preface this one as saying specifically recommendability for people that are putting together their fourth Doctor necessary collection. So let's just put that label on it. So if you feel it's anything other than that, then please specify. But Jay, what would you say for recommendability and rewatchability and recommendability?
Rewatchability, and I'm not sure because I enjoyed watching it the first time because it was new. I don't know how well the mystery of it and everything is going to play the second time. And it didn't seem like there was enough outside of Baker. I didn't feel like there was, and Louise Jameson to a lesser extent. I don't feel like there was anything like standout performances that were like, I want to watch this again because that's incredible or whatever. Mm-hmm. The story was kind of like a one and done kind of like once you know it, you're pretty much done with it kind of thing. So I'd be interested to go back and see if that actually holds up. That's just my impression right now.
All right. So can I just I'll add one thing to that. I will say, speaking of someone who's come around to it on repeat watches, now that the mystery is solved, the fun is going back to rewatch it and see what clues were being handed to y'all.
OK, so I can see that.
OK, so what about recommendability?
I'm going to say yes, because as we mentioned, this was the chance to see the doctor in a fallible state. This was the chance to really see Baker kind of play around with the, you know, I've done so many things that I can't even begin to remember half of them kind of thing. It was a new and interesting take on the doctor that I don't think would have been as believable from anyone other than Baker.
Okay.
So yeah, I would absolutely recommend this, all given right. the caveat that we said earlier.
Okay. Haley, where do you stand?
So recommendability, I have to say yes for what Jay said about the fallibility of the Doctor. That's always fun to see. And also, it's the introduction of a new companion, which I feel like is always an important episode to get under your belt if you're planning on watching any amount of Doctor Who.
Mm-hmm.
Rewatchability, I guess there's the thing you said about like going back and seeing the clues. But for me personally, this has a problem that a lot of this run of stories has had. And it's the lack of women sticks out like a sore thumb, and it really, really bothers me.
Yeah.
If it were one story, it would be one thing. It'd be, you could be like, well, that's just that one story. But it's so many of them in a row
it seems to be a decade.
Really,
yeah, it's a,
really starting to rub me the wrong way.
Yeah, no, that's understandable. I will say I wish that there was a light at the end of the tunnel. We're not there yet.
Yeah. And it's not even like it's a problematic portrayal of women, which I would kind of expect at this time. There's no women at all.
I can't say it's problematic when they're not there to be the problem.
Yeah. Hey, how do you avoid a problematic portrayal of women? Just don't have any. Guys, we solved sexism.
Lesser of two evils, I guess.
Oh, God. It's the cinematic version of your fingers in your ears. La, 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 la. Okay. I have to sort of agree with you both. This is something where rewatchability, I'll say that, speaking of someone who's been, you know, at least a half a dozen views into it, I think it still holds up. Is it, does that make it any better? No, it still has problems a mile wide, as does a vast majority of season 14. It's happening, and you can't ignore it, and you can't write it off. And no, it's not going to get better because we've got some big problems looming on the horizon. But as far as recommendability, yes, yeah, specifically because this is a sort of an unorthodox introduction to a companion, an unlikely companion. A companion who I think really establishes herself, despite the fact that she is clearly trying to be provided. I gotta wonder if there was some sort of a disconnect between what the writer was intending her to be and the strength that he was trying to imbue her with and what Jameson was actually bringing to the character. And then what the producers might have wanted to say, we just need eye candy or whatever horrible intent might have been there, but she defied it. You know, she clearly, I mean, you get reminders throughout that there's far more to this character and far more to this actor than what they might have originally intended or hell, what they dressed her for. Let's be honest. So that in and of itself, I think is worth experiencing. The broken doctor, or at least the problematic doctor, the forgetful doctor, I think is a great thing to see, especially when it's being done by Baker, who wears it so well. And a lot of the heavy lifting that he does in the story, because he and Jameson are essentially the only characters that matter, really. Unfortunately, everybody else is kind of dismissible. Interesting.
Well, 'cause you know, nobody else has any importance beyond this story.
Yeah. Tomas has some credibility, because he's, you know, his empathy, and his concern, his ability to be able to see through even his own tribespeople's, blinders, but it's not necessarily carried to the point where you'd want to say, God, I really want to see what's going to happen with him 30 years from now. It's just not there.
No, he tripped and fell on a Janice Thorn.
Yeah. Yeah. Oops.
You also know, like, it seems like they're all just carrying those, like, loose in a pouch on their belt, and they've got to, like, you know, reach around in there, try and find one.
Well, even when she's got one in her hands, back in episode one, you know, the doctor yells at her, no more Janice Thorns and things, and she looks down at it, and she's just holding it loose in her palm.
She's like, what do I do with it now?
That's, well, it's just, yeah, you know, this is how medical waste accidents happen.
Right.
All right. Well, there you go. So yeah. All in all, I consider it a solid story, but it is a solid story with a lot of baggage, like many of us.
Yeah.
There you go.
So are we ready to get into the news?
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah. Let's get it.
Okay. We lost an important contributor to the Doctor Who universe today as we're recording. Mm-hmm. Loss of Graham Curry. Overnight, news came about. I heard it from Andrew Cardmell, who we've spoken with before. Graham Curry was obviously the writer for Happiness Patrol, which is his first commission writing for Doctor Who. I think it might have even been his first television commission entirely, if memory serves. Went on to write for the EastEnders and things of that sort, but remained very good friends with Andrew throughout. We lost him at the age of 54. Apparently, according to a serious illness, you know, more details have not been really divulged, but our hearts and our thoughts go out to the family and to Andrew as well for losing a dear friend. So, do us a favor. Go, even if it's out of order, go spin up the Happiness Patrol and watch it over the next week or so if you have the opportunity, because, it was a great contribution to our legacy. Jake, give me something happier to chew on.
How about a chance to watch Mission to the Unknown?
You mean in a version that's not the animated Ian Levine thing from like 15 years ago? Yes, please.
yeah.
Okay, so yeah, Mission of the Unknown, third season, back in the Hartnell era. It was intended to be a lead-in to the Daleks Master Plan, and was the only instance where a single episode story was done for a long, long time, and had obviously it's among the lost episodes. We have our audio, but it was shot during the same production block as Galaxy 4, which was a four-episode story. Levine commissioned to have it redone in animation back in the early 2000s. From my understanding, this is, being a Terry Nation script, also being Verity Lambert's last episode produced. So it has a means of historical significance on a number of counts there, but I guess according to Peter Purves himself, and that's how we found out about this, was through a tweet on his part, that they are going to be remaking it entirely. So they're going to be reshooting the story in its entirety on full sets and costumes. And they began doing this last week as we're recording. So they said that it was, according to Peter, it was going to be a 3-day multi-camera shoot. And they're hoping that the final cut of it will be something they can hand over to the BBC to potentially release it as additional features on a DVD or in this case, Blu-ray release to come. I just think that's a really cool, of all the things that you could latch on to, the idea to go ahead and take this story out of anything and say, all right, well, we're not going to do it animated because that's what everybody's doing these days. But the University of Central Lancashire says that they're going to do, all right, well, let's do a full shoot. Granted, I don't know what they're doing for Hartnell's Doctor, but I, or whether they're going to utilize the audio and do the shoot and overdub using the existing audio as if they would do a reconstruction or something. Which I think would probably be the best way to go about it. That way, you know, you're catching the spirit of it shot for shot, right, scene for scene, for pacing and everything.
Yeah.
But the tricky part here, as far as I'm seeing it, is this is a setup for like the Dalek Supreme character and everything. So as we've seen with some of the other Dalek stories that have been restored, are you going to hand it over to Nick Briggs and say, hey, would you mind re-recording all your Dalek voices for this? Yeah. Huh. I want to keep an eye on this. This is going to be seriously cool.
Yeah, I'm interested to see how this turns out. If nothing else, just, you know, anytime we get a reconstruction that's not the same old.
Yeah.
I mean, as thankful as I am for a lot of those, because otherwise we wouldn't see anything at all.
Right.
Like, you know, the animation is a step up from, you know, the slideshow of screen captures, and then there's varying degrees of the animation and stuff. So it's like I'm always excited to see somebody be like, you know what, we're going to try this again a different way.
Oh, wait a second,
bring it on again.
I'm thinking through this. I think if I'm remembering correctly, this was the story that was used as this. It was establishing the setup for what was going to be the whole Dalek arc to come, but it didn't actually have the Doctor in it. It's numbered, it's sequenced, it's put within, it's considered what 18th or 19th story, you know, and they place it within the sequence of episodes. But I don't think Hartnell's actually in it.
Huh.
Which I guess saves them quite a bit of trouble.
Yeah.
Okay. That's
all right.
All right. Yeah. I'm gonna keep digging into this because this is this. I can see it as having the opportunity of being an interesting project for the university students to play around with you know, beloved property, but without having to worry too much about some of the tetchier aspects of the production. You know, what do we do for Hartnell? What do we do for the voices? What do we do for, well, oh, the rights to the Terry Nation estates? Although I think they did give special permission for the episode to be recorded. Anyway, so 25 minutes of who knows what is going to be handed to us. And maybe they'll make it available out on the interwebs before the, well, as they're trying to seek resolution from the BBC as to whether or not they're going to include it in something down the road. But there's some cool photos out there of Peter Purves and Nick Briggs on set. So maybe, maybe.
I say bring it on.
Yeah, cool. All right, so what else we got?
So, you know, as much as we might have issues with not enough female representation in some of the classic episodes that we're watching now, Chris Chibnall knew right away that that wasn't going to be a problem for his series because he actually knew that the 13th Doctor was going to be a woman before he ever cast – before he even started thinking about casting.
Mm. Well, we had always gotten the impression from him right when he first took on the mantle that he had a storyline he wanted to tell, as you would hope most showrunners do. You know, this this is where the story stands. This is where I want to take it. And there are some things that I'm going to need in place in order for that to happen. So if one of those pillars of that foundation says I need a woman doctor, but okay, now you got to find her. So I'm looking through the story here to try and determine exactly because I'm surprised it took this long for the information to actually get discussed. But this came through Jody while she was talking to Tennant on his podcast, which, by the way, is freaking delightful.
I've only been able to listen to the first episode so far, which was excellent.
Yeah, the one with Olivia Colman. Yeah. So I'm sorry. Academy Award winner Olivia Colman. Let's just make sure that we, let's just address that. The completely underutilized Whovian cast member, Olivia Colman.
It's a shame that it's unheard of for Doctor Who to bring back actors to play different characters.
Yeah, of course not. Yeah.
Right? Yeah.
So,
although, I mean, to be fair, would you bother coming back at this point?
Yeah. Yeah.
I mean, not us particularly, because, you know, we're super nerds, but
So apparently she in her conversations with Chibnall post Broadchurch, she was discussing a potential role on the show when she found out that he was going to be taking on the mantle of showrunner and thought that she was going to be up for a villain character, which how freaking cool could that be, by the way? Let's just put that aside for a second. Put that in your hypothetical box. An evil Jodie Whittaker. Yes, please.
Yes please. Yeah.
So now I need one of these dueling doctors episodes to come, kind of like the Mr. Clever thing. There you go. So hand it to Neil Gaiman. Tell him that he needs to do a 13 and Evil 13 episode. I love where this is going. All right, but so she sits down with Chris Chibnall and what did Olivia Colman call him? Chinball? Yeah. She was referring to him as Chinball. So that's lovely. That's never going to go away. It's on the internet now. And he said, yeah. So it's kind of funny that you should mention being on Doctor Who. But I'm planning on casting a woman. So hey, you want to come in for an audition and a screen test? So cool. I wonder if he didn't really have his eye on her the entire time, and the auditioning process was really just a matter of formality.
Clever ruse.
Well, just a formality, you know. Well, you never want to. You never completely close the door on another opportunity, but you know, you've got your A-listers and you got your B and your C-listers, and his A-list was a list of one. So there you go.
Well, speaking of the 13th Doctor, How would you like a chance to have breakfast with her and Mandip Gill?
Oh, I would love it, but I read the rules on this and I can't do it.
Yes. Haley, please explain why, as much as Comic Relief wants to send any lucky fan with 10 pounds in their pocket who wants to give to the kids for Red Nose Day, yeah, but not you.
Right. So you enter this drawing, 10 pounds per entry. I don't remember how many times you can enter. Doesn't matter because I can't enter because you must be a UK resident over the age of 18. And your guests may be under the age of 18 as long as you're their parent or guardian and they're over 14, blah, blah, blah. I quit reading at that point because I couldn't go.
Not that she's bitter or anything.
Then she had
Kira was talking to me about something. And I was like, yeah, yap awake here. I'm trying to figure out how I can meet Jody and Mandeep. And I can't. That's how.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, for our listeners within the UK proper, please enter for us. We can be your guardian. Any of the three of us can be there within 24 hours notice. Yeah. So get your entries in by March 15th, I think might be your deadline.
Sure. You get to have breakfast on the set with the 13th Doctor and one of her friends.
Yes. We're there. We all enjoy breakfast. And we are capable of travel. I think we all have our passports in order.
I do.
Yep.
Yep.
Okay. There you go. So let us know when you win. And we will be at Heathrow within a day and a half. Easy. So there you go.
Next week, we're going to go back to our fun game times. We're going to be playing the blank of Rassilon.
Yeah. Correct me if I'm wrong, but we toyed around with this as sort of an extra segment at some point months ago.
We've been brainstorming this idea for a while.
Yeah. We earmarked it as one that had potential if Kira could figure out the rules a little better. So this buys me a week to figure out the rules a little better.
So listen in next week for this train wreck.
But this is one where I want to try to get a little bit of listener involvement in the week buildup. So I'm going to actually start I'll primarily lean on Twitter for this one, but I might throw a few things on Facebook and Instagram as well through our Gallery Public Radio accounts, so keep an eye on those things. By the way, if you don't follow us on Instagram, it's at Gallery Public Radio. Facebook, it's whatever. You know how Facebook works. It's pretty simple. It's a search engine in and of itself.
Yeah.
But on Twitter, if you do not follow us, it's at Gallery Radio. I will prompt you with some randomly selected nouns that happen to be little known relics of Rassilon. And I would ask any of you to give me a short description of the power that object conveys or possesses, such as the, the eight-pointed Lego block of Rassilon, or the fidget spinner of Rassilon, or something along those lines. So you get where we're going with this. We had some fun with it when we played with it for just a quick 5 minutes and realized that it had the potential of being something extremely stupid, and stupid is right up our alley.
Exactly.
So there you go.
Yeah. So yeah, if you definitely go and follow us on all the social medias to keep up to date on that. And while you're at it, why don't you head over to iTunes or Google Play or wherever it is that you get this podcast from and leave us a review. Give us a rating and let us know how we're doing. Spread the word.
Mm-hmm.
Anyway. All right. Well, this has been episode 324 of Gallifrey Public Radio. Until next week, this is Jay saying, I must have made quite an impression.
And this is Kira saying, well, conversation could have been tighter. Podcast notes could have been more prepared. Still, mustn't complain. We live in an imperfect universe.
And this is Haley saying, I think the Doctor needs to upgrade the sex ed curriculum that he's uploading to quasi-sentient AIs.
Touche.
We'll see you guys next week.
Owlsy.
Goodbye.
Thanks for joining us for another episode of Gallifrey Public Radio. Join us each week for new episodes. We love getting feedback from listeners, so don't hesitate to share your thoughts with us. You can email us at feedback@gallifreypublicradio.com, tell us on Twitter @GallifreyRadio, or on Facebook at facebook.com/GallifreyPublicRadio. You can also leave us a voicemail for inclusion in future shows at 210-802-1477. That's 210-802-1GPR. You should also go to GunnaGeek.com and check out lots of other high-quality geek-centric shows, or visit forums.GunnaGeek.com to talk about anything geeky with us or the community.
Prompted you on
this. Yeah, but I wasn't listening. I was looking at the rules for the other thing.
Okay, so I'm going to make a note for an edit point.